Welcome to the Grind Hill Chronicles podcast. I'm your host, Don Bishop, and I write as T.S. Pedramon. Today, I am here with librarian Jared. I did not ask you how to pronounce it. Is that Anjweerden?
Anjweerden, yes.
Anjweerden.
Yeah, that's right. The short version of the name.
Okay. Yes, so I'm here with librarian Anjweerden, who is a librarian in the Salt Lake County system, which is a large library system. And yeah, we'll have a talk about his observations and statistical observations included, especially, I guess, from the library perspective side of things. So first off, Jared, let's get to know you a little bit. What's your background as far as education or previous jobs related to literature or unrelated? Like I was a musician, you know?
I'm just, you know, born and raised in Utah. My dad was the first born in America for his family. They're from Holland originally. They stayed there for quite a long while. They, you know, same 1,000 square miles of the country since between like 400 AD until 1945. But, you know, my schooling was in English literature officially, although I have most of a degree in biology.
Okay.
The last couple of years, I realized it wasn't for me and switched to English. And then I have a master's of library science, which, you know, I needed for my job. I've been working for the library system for 17 years now. Started off shelving books and just moved up continually. I also write books of my own, science fiction, fantasy, mostly for teens. So I do everything that, you know, I'm a teen librarian, I write for teens. So that's just kind of the area I am immersed in.
Yeah. Now, I think that's awesome. And, you know, like my wife has this t-shirt, it's a library thing. Libraries are great places. And I've kind of wondered from time to time what it would be like, kind of to be on the inside. So now, you know, for everybody else's perspective, I'll say it, but I invited you on the podcast after you shared on a Facebook group that we're both in, stats that you've seen. Oh, wait, so hold up, before, we should still get to know you a little bit better. I know that you do some writing. So, what do you write? I think you mentioned some science fiction that you're doing.
Yeah, my main series is called The Black Chronicle. Starts with the long black. It's I kind of call it blue collar sci-fi. It's kind of military sci-fi adjacent because, you know, I love military sci-fi, but I don't have a military background, and so I kind of get around that by first asking a lot of questions and, you know, beta readers and stuff. But also, the main character isn't in the military. She starts off working the mines on a heavy gravity planet that's really not a great place to live. Escapes from there, lies about her age to go to school, and becomes a starship mechanic.
Is she strong because of where she grew up?
Relatively, yeah. I mean, she's, I think I figured, I was like using as a basis in my mind, some of like the flyweight wrestlers. And so she's like not even 5 foot tall, but is pretty solidly built for her size.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, she is stronger than she would be normally. Still has trouble if she's going up against a guy who's like, you know, 3 times her weight or, you know, 2 feet taller than she is. But now, in her case, like I said, the drama comes in that she just wanted to be a mechanic and see the stars. But, oh, hey, there's space pirates. Oh, hey, there's someone trying to assassinate her friend, or space pirates more. And then later on in the series, her homeworld actually invades the star system she had moved to, because they want off the heavy gravity planet. They want to live somewhere nicer.
Uh-huh.
And so she just keeps getting involved in more and more things from a military side of things, even though that's not her background. And she would just assume not.
Okay.
Apart from that, I wrote some steampunk, some fantasy. I actually have one romance novel. It was not meant to be romance. It was supposed to be a superhero adventure story. And then the characters insisted that the bank robbery in chapter one was a great chance to flirt with each other, and I finally just gave up and let the characters do what they wanted. So yeah. That was a superhero romance.
So would you call yourself a plotter or a pantser or somewhere in the middle?
Mostly in the middle. I mean, I have a general idea of where things are going and what like the bad guys are doing in the background. But then I just create the characters and get a good feel for them and then just throw them at the situation and then see how they would react and go from there.
Yeah. Yep. And and I think the plotting and the pantsing are two processes that can and maybe should inform each other. Because when you're in the middle of writing the scene, you're going to observe things a different way. And you're going to come out with some ideas that are really great ideas that you wouldn't have during the planning phase when you're looking big picture.
Mm-hmm.
So,
anyway. Yeah, and I find, you know, like I said, you know, having the characters run wild, I think, helps with the verisimilitude of it. Because, you know, there's only so much you can keep in your mind at once, but if you let your subconscious out to play a little bit, it can improve the product. Although there are dangers to that too, because if you have too little structure, then you end up meandering and going nowhere.
Yep. Yep. I had a good discussion about plotting versus pantsing the other day. What day was that? It was like 3 weeks ago. Wow. 3 weeks ago tomorrow. But that conversation comes out on this Thursday, February 1st. Of course, our conversation right now, for us, it's January 30th. For the listeners, it's February 22nd. But if anybody wants to hear that conversation with Todd Fonestock, that's February 1st, about plotting versus pantsing. But so let's go ahead and bring up these stats. So I invited you on the podcast after you posted in this Facebook group and shared these statistics of so you're a teen librarian. And so you shared these statistics of what teens are checking out these days actively, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So what I thought it was really fascinating, but I don't want to just like read your post to everybody on the air.
Summarize it. So, you know, libraries are interesting. Is that part of it is that, you know, we will take a lot more risks about getting books that may not be interesting or worthwhile than a, you know, normal person would, because we have to try and serve everybody. And we really should have books everybody will like. And so our system as a whole, there's 18 branches, and just teen fiction books, there's 75,000 of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and constantly having turnover with that.
And that's individual copies within the Salt Lake County system.
So that's not distinct titles. I mean, some books will have one copy in the whole system, others will have literally hundreds, depending on demand.
Okay.
And a lot of them just kind of sit there, because, like, looking at last year, 75,000 books, but 21,000 of them didn't go out at all in 2023.
Now, how do you delineate for what you call teen books? Like, would my book fall as a teen book? It's a YA fantasy. It comes out next month. If the Salt Lake County Library System were to stock my book, would it be a teen book? The character is about 17 years old. How do you decide that?
It's not an exact science, despite being library science. generally, we mostly will just trust what the publisher and author are saying, but not always. A couple examples just from my own library. It's like I ordered the three books in Reborn as a Vending Machine, Now I Wander the Dungeon. Yeah, that's the title of the book.
Uh-huh.
Because a show was made about it. I'm like, okay, that'll be more popular now. So I ordered it. And it was just three books in the whole series. Because, I mean, how far can you really take a concept where the main character is a vending machine?
Uh-huh.
Well,
I have a friend who wrote a series where the main character is a skeleton.
Well, hey, I've seen great ones for that. I've seen a really good one where the main character was like reborn as a sword. It's like they are a sentient sword, And so basically the main character is this sword who is mentoring this young girl who wants to become an adventurer. And so she's the protagonist, but he's the viewpoint character, and he's much more like a father figure mentor. He just can't move on his own because he's a sword. But anyway, with this one, the vending machine one, the book itself is labeled as 13 up. The the main character is older, because I find with Western fiction, they do get very caught up with the age of the character being a good indicator of where it goes.
Uh-huh.
A lot of Asian literature doesn't. And so like a book like this, where the main character was in his late 30s, is still intended for teens because of the content matter. Whereas another series, like one called Go Furry, which is about a girl playing an online virtual reality video game, that one's intended for adults because it's meant to be like relaxing. And so even though the main character is a young teenager, it's geared to adults. Anyway, in this case, it's geared to teens. But when we got it, it was moved into adults, mostly because being a light novel, it has illustrations, and a lot of those illustrations were about, two wisps of steam away from nudity.
Uh-huh.
And obviously the views on nudity vary from country to country. In Japan, in a non-sexual context, it's much more permissive, uh-huh. I mean, like, you know, communal bathing and all that. And so for there, it was firmly teen. Here, they decided to move to adult. That's just an example.
Yeah. Yeah.
But generally speaking, yeah, it is mostly what the author says and what the content is. And I think to a too much degree, the age of the protagonist.
Okay. Yeah, I actually remember when I was in elementary school, we had an author visit our school, and he said that he had asked some other author that he respected, and he named a name. I don't remember who it was, but he's like, how do you write books for children? Like, how do you make sure that it's going to be, you use language that they're going to understand? And the other writer said, you just make the main character that age, and they'll learn the words. But I know that that's not the most popular way to look at it. But
I kind of agree with him. I mean, like, there's always some tensions between, like, say, school teachers and librarians, because school teachers, and I'm not saying they shouldn't be, but they are more concerned with reading level and appropriateness and stuff like that. And there's libraries, you know, public libraries especially, we're like, well, here's the stuff. If parents should definitely be involved and pay attention, but we're not going to worry about that. That's not our job. We're here to get people to read.
Yeah.
And so stuff like graphic novels, we really like for kids to read those because, one, it helps the kids who are, you know, not so keen on reading to read. And two, it's actually a really good way to learn vocabulary because, like, even you know, DC and Marvel, the Cape comics, those actually will have a higher vocabulary level than most comparable stuff for that age range. It's just that with the context of the pictures, it's easier to figure out what it means.
I think even still, like, I am in that camp where I think people will learn it. They'll pick it up from the context. Mm-hmm. I've been wondering if I should temper that position, because with my beta reader feedback coming back from various readers, I've had more than one intelligent adult beta reader not know a term and think that I meant another term. And it reminds me of, so when I was a missionary, I learned to speak Spanish. And if I say so myself, I did better at it than most missionaries. And so there was a time or two when I told a joke that was a pun in Spanish, and people thought I meant to say something that would be more what you would expect somebody to say. And I'm like, no, I'm trying to tell this joke. Like, take what I'm saying at face value, and you'll receive the joke. And I can tell one of them because I remember it. But the word casar, C-A-S-A-R. Yeah. Or more appropriately, casarse is to get married. But if you change the S to a Z, in Spain it's pronounced differently. It'd be cazar. But in the Americas, it's cazar. It sounds the same, but it means to hunt. And so I made a joke with a member of the church out there that, you know, after my mission, I'm going to cazar una mujer. And, you know, I'm joking. I'm gonna hunt a woman. And he's like, you mean you'll get married with a woman? He's like, you mean casarte con? And I'm like, no, like, first I'll have to hunt her down. Then I'll get married to her. So,
well, and, it was a, and see, it was kind of I actually joke, do speak Spanish honestly. Too. So,
yeah.
No, it's a great joke.
But
I think part of that's cultural. Because, like,
so
puns aren't as prevalent in, like, I learned Spanish in Mexico. And they don't really do puns down there. They do other kinds of jokes.
Yeah, if
but like
they do a lot of
America
inappropriate puns. They call doble sentido.
Yeah. Well, I'm just reminded of like because I mean a bit of a tangent there, but like Mexico, there is a distinct comic style that Mexico has, or at least had. I haven't been there in a while. And most of the artists I knew from Mexico were very intentionally using Japanese manga style because the Mexican style was so firmly connotated with dirty comics. And so they just refused to use
it.
But yeah, it's like, you know, puns are very interesting because like America, we love puns. China loves puns. Like Chinese puns are amazing. I mean, like all over the place. Thinking something
that's
simple,
interesting.
Like,
I never knew that. And
can you
really write puns in Chinese?
Well,
I mean, I guess you could write it. It would sound
yes. Well, and it's all played on like homonyms and like okay. So here's an example I remember, and I'm hoping I'm remembering it correctly because it's been a while since I actually had explained to me by a boss I had who was from Taiwan. But like, so those red balloons you see like at New Year's, they'll have a symbol on them. If I remember correctly, it's a symbol for bat upside down. Because the word for bat and the word for luck.
Unfortunately, the audio recording cut out here. We'll come right back in a second.
The word for has arrived. So upside down bat symbol means luck has arrived. It's just pure puns. And it's glorious.
Okay.
But yeah, I know. I love all that sound basically the same. And the word for upside down, I forget how, but it relates to kind of pun stuff, but not everyone does. As for the question about language in books, yeah.
So in my book, I'm not even telling a pun, but I talk about these people coming of age, right? And here's somebody giving a speech, or kind of introducing this ceremony or this event. And she says, our program tonight, following our tradition, includes a special dance performed by our young men and women who have reached the age of majority and prepared to formally join our local community. But apparently not everybody knows the term, the age of majority. And I've seen a couple of comments back, age of maturity. Like, did you mean age of maturity?
I would leave.
And it also makes sense. But age of majority,
it's a real thing,
is the term for this thing. And I don't fault anybody for not being familiar with it, but I did kind of expect it to be common knowledge.
Yeah, I mean, that's tricky because age of majority and age of maturity are similar, but they're not the same thing. And so I would say leave it and they learn something new. It's tricky because, like, I mean, I can think of some authors who would just go so far in for the flowery language and obscure words that gets in the way of the book itself, unless you're really good at that. But I still say it's like, well, okay, so it was a conversation. It's a good example of not quite the same. It's like with a lot of things, you want to be subtle because it's just, I mean, if you try and beat people over the head with definitions or a theme or stuff, it just gets pedantic and annoying and preachy.
So I wondered if maybe I should have one character incorrectly correct another character. And it's like, did you mean age of maturity? And well, no, I mean majority. That's the term.
Yeah. Plenty of adults out there who are past the age of majority, but are not mature yet. But no, yeah, I'd say leave it because, I mean, like an example I used was I was watching Bollywood films. I love Bollywood films. They're great. And the storyline is this guy is going back to a school where he was expelled from for falling in love with the headmaster's daughter. And he's gone back there to try and make the headmaster change his ways and stop being so draconian about like absolutely no dating. If you fall in love, you get expelled and all of this. And there's all these scenes. We have all the students in their black uniforms and he's always dressed in white. And he's, you know, he's there working as the music teacher. He's in disguise and blah, blah, blah. And then I was watching a different Bollywood film, happened to be the same actor, but, and they attend a funeral and they're all in white. And I clicked like, oh, wait, yeah, I knew that. In Hinduism and a bunch of religions over there, black isn't the mourning color, white is. And so the guy in disguise as the teacher being in white isn't just to differentiate him from the students. It's also that he is in mourning because the girl he fell in love with died. Mm-hmm. And the whole movie is about him coming to terms with that grief and the headmaster with his grief. And so, like, you know, the entire movie, he's in black, the headmaster. And then at the last scene, they're together and they're both in white. And so, like, I missed that the first four or five times I saw that film. But I still loved it. I still enjoyed it. And then when it clicked, it made it so much better. But if they just come out and told me, oh, he's wearing white because he's still mourning, that would have ruined it. That would have been, you know, too obvious. And so, like, with vocabulary, I'd say it's the same way. You know, go ahead and use the vocabulary that fits best. I mean, don't try and be, like, prove you're smarter than everybody by using obscure words. But, you know, use what's appropriate. And then if they get it, great. They've you know, got the scene and they got something out of it. And if they don't, well, maybe they'll learn. And if they don't, well, then they'll get something else out of it. And maybe later they will.
I do need to look at my manuscript carefully because I've had some readers think that I was trying to use big words. And anyway, so statistics. Shall we, can we actually go ahead and plow through these statistics? Because I thought they were really, really fascinating. All right. And I think they could be interesting for others.
Yes. Okay. So to summarize, so 75,000 books for teens in the system. That's individual copies.
Is across 18 branches in the system.
Okay. Yeah, and we are one of the busiest in the country. I know we were top five a few years. I don't know where we're at right now, but I mean,
now as we go through these stats and you talk about things that have been checked out this year, we're talking late 2023.
Yeah. So this is all for 2023. Okay. I won't be able to pull stats for this year because technically our computer system we use doesn't give this data directly. I have to come at it from the side. But one of the consequences of that is I can only do it for the current year. I can't go back and do it for like last year anymore. And so I have to wait till late in this year to run this again. But okay, so 75,000 books, generally.
Uh-oh, I don't hear you. It probably still is recording you, maybe. Okay, I hear you again. Okay, so for the computer system you use, you can't pull from this year yet, it's too early, but you also can't pull from last year. So these stats that we're going to discuss are as of late 2023. Every time we say this year, we're talking about 2023.
Yeah, because I...
Okay.
Yeah, because I got to massage the system. Anyway, so 75,000 books, 15% out any given moment. But 21,000 didn't go out at all in 2023. Mm-hmm. And 6,000 had never gone out. And since this was late in the year, that's actually lower than it would have been because late in the year, like, you know, I'll pull a list. Anything that hasn't gone out in 2 years, I'll generally get rid of it because we have to. I mean, like... Just this month, I got 30 new books in, and I haven't done any ordering yet for this year. And so, generally, I'll get between 50 and 100 new books every month. And I got to make room for them, so old stuff has to go. It's just what it is. So 6,000 had never gone out, and that's low, because we were already in the process of getting rid of a bunch of those. To use my library example, I have 3,500 books before I started
at your branch,
and then got down to 3,000 with the idea that Yeah, that's just my branch. I do actually have one of the larger teen sections. I mean, not the...
Mm-hmm.
For my size of library, it's the largest. And it's actually not too much smaller than the bigger libraries.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that's because at my library, we don't get a ton of teens coming in and staying, but the actual books go out more than most of the other sections. I mean, I can't pull that up right now, but like January is generally pretty slow. You know, the holidays are over, people are back to school. And so in January, 10% of our collection was out,
okay.
But almost 20% of the teen books. So, but yeah, got rid of 500 of them. Now on the extreme other end, 6,000 of those 75,000 went out at least 10 times
definitely a
during the year.
Popularity spread among the books.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah. So those 6,000, that's 1,000 different titles. And 175 of those titles went out more than 100 times over the year. And even then, that 175 titles is only 64 authors. So it definitely, you know, the very popular stuff is dominating, but there's still mm-hmm. a lot of other stuff that is still reasonably popular. I mean, for the whole year, The Lightning Thief, yeah, single most popular book. That one title more than 1,000 times was borrowed over the year. And so, you know, all these books, like 8%, I would probably say is popular. And of that, the top 17% of the 8%, so about 1% of the books, is most of our circulation.
These are 1,000 titles, right? So
yeah.
75,000 books are 1,000 different books. Is that accurate?
Okay. Yeah. So the 1,000 titles, that's a different books, you know, like I said, we probably have
however many branches, 18 branches. And so you're going to want to have, I don't know, 3 copies of The Lightning Thief per branch.
Mostly. My branch, for example, I try not to have too many books, multiple copies, because I don't generally need them. And I like to have a better variety.
Yeah.
But Lightning, all of that series, all of his books, I have either 2 or 3. I mean, and then there's other books like, say, on the other end, Hatchet.
Uh-huh.
Hatchet is still very popular after more than 40 years. So I have 3 copies of every book in the Hatchet series.
Okay.
And what's popular tends to stay popular, at least the very high end. Although I'd say out of 3,500 books, probably at most 30 are from the early 90s or farther back.
Uh-huh.
Simply because of space issues and popularity.
So I'm trying to understand this sentence. So 175 of the titles had gone out more than 100 times. Those 175 titles were written by 64 authors. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then 174 to 543 on the list, on the popularity list of titles, were less than, fewer, they'd been checked out fewer than 100 times, but more than 21 times.
Yeah.
And then 544 through the end, fewer than 16 times, most only 11. Nothing was borrowed between 21 and 17 times.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is not really relevant, but it was interesting. It's like, why not none of those?
I guess, that is interesting. I picture somewhere between 1 and 16 people deciding to give this book a try and then not recommending it. And so then you have, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And then, you know, it's also interesting because obviously, you know, like Lightning Thief, where we have potentially hundreds of copies.
Times of borrows.
Yeah.
The Lightning Thief was borrowed more than 1,000 times this year in 2023.
Yep. But see, the nice thing is with the library, since we do have such broad range, there's still room for smaller books. Like, you know, so my branch specifically, I have a dedicated section for Japanese light novels.
Uh-huh.
This is for a bunch of different reasons. The primary one, of course, is they're popular. Like, in graphic novels, the manga is doing so much better than anything out of the West. You know, Marvel and DC are not checking out like they used to, and manga is just super popular. Now, in kids, that's a different story. In kids' graphic novels, stuff like Dogman or even, you know, Diver Wimpy Kid or Babysitter's Club, even still, the graphic novels, those go out tons. But for teens and adults, the manga is dominating. Anyway, but in the books, it's kind of the same way. There's a lot of interest in that. And so, yeah, of those, well, now 3,000 books, I got rid of a bunch, 500 of them are from Japan. And that's partly because, again, they're popular, partly because since I'm intentionally getting them, there are a lot of series that my branch will have that no one else does. And so that helps them be popular, partly because of low supply. And so those go out to other libraries for patrons who want them quite a lot as well.
Uh-huh.
And so there's still room for smaller stuff. Another reason, of course, is that teen fiction from traditional publishers is very heavily weighted towards what I call, you know, girl interest books. Like, you know, obviously, readers are individuals. They'll read a lot of different things. But generally speaking, most of the books coming out will appeal to the average girl much more than the average boy. And so I'm very intentionally trying to get stuff for boys along with the stuff for girls. And it's actually quite a lot easier to get books with a male focus and a male protagonist from Japan than it is that I trad publishing for new stuff.
And this goes, this makes me wonder about my Facebook ads. I'm currently running Facebook ads for my Kickstarter campaign that ends tomorrow, and I kind of had to target the ad toward either men or women. I didn't have to. I could have run it anyway, but the system warned me that my audience was probably too broad, and since it's kind of a bidding war to get your ad in front of people's eyes, it said I might not get any views, might not have my ad displayed to anybody. So I targeted, and I decided to target men just because I believe it's more common for men to read epic fantasy. But I've wondered if I should target women, especially because the main character is female and, unicorns are big in this book. Now, they're not like fluffy and pooping rainbows unicorns, but I wonder if the simple fact of could be deterring men. In fact, I'm going to go and change the targeting right now. So I have equal target. I'm only going to run this ad for 3 days. It started yesterday, and I'm going to pull it after tomorrow because then the Kickstarter campaign won't be live anymore.
Yeah, and that is a very real consideration. And I mean, like, my novels all have female protagonists for a few different reasons. One, just because it amuses me more and it's more fun to write. Two, because at least for me, I very intentionally want to write about people not like me. And so having them not be male is an easy way to accomplish that. And I have had people tell me to my face that they won't pick up my series because it's science fiction with a female lead. Now, that's not saying anything about my book. It's saying something about what they've been, well, them and what they've been exposed to in the past. Because it's like, I mean, it's very, you know, politically charged and all that, but it is, you know, very easy to see that we are at a point where, like, female superheroes aren't doing as well. And part of that is fatigue. Part of that is how they're written. It's like we do get a lot of these female characters who, I don't want to like be too mean to other authors and stuff, but basically it's like there's a few ways to go about it. You can, you know, make all the men bumbling idiots like you see in sitcoms a lot of the time, and make the woman look better that way.
Uh-huh.
Or you can, you know, make the character competent and have them stand alongside the other. So it's like, but there's been so many books and movies and so on where it's, you know, here I am, strong woman, hear me roar, all the men are idiots. And a lot of people are just tired of that. And it's not so much that the woman is strong, but necessarily they're tired of all the men being idiots. And so they've been taught, rightly or wrongly, that a female-led science fiction book might mean that all the men are idiots and it's a waste of their time. That, of course, isn't true across the board. David Weber, his Honor Harrington series is amazing and one of the best sellers in all of science fiction right now. And of course, you know, she's a very strong character and very competent and cool. But then again, of course, there's, you know, hundreds of other characters who are just as competent as she is and just as cool, who are men, women, and, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And
aliens, even.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, you know, every choice you make will limit the audience in some way, both for good reasons and for reasons that are ultimately not necessarily fair, but fair doesn't come into it. It's just, you got to take it as it is. It's like, are there guys who won't read my series because there's a woman on the cover? Yes. Do I blame them for that choice? No. If I could talk with them and explain, maybe they would change their mind. But it's like, you know, how did someone put it? It's like, as authors, we're always competing with people's beer money. It's like, do they want to buy this book or do they want to buy a beer or whatever it is they drink? You know, their leisure activities. And so, you know, there's always more options than they can ever get to. And so getting mad about them, you know, choosing, like, okay, this one has a woman on the cover, it's science fiction, it probably isn't for me, moving on. That's not them condemning my book. It's just they have to move quickly and decide because there's just too many options.
Yeah.
And so you have to take it as it is.
There are movies out there that they try too hard to focus on having a strong female lead, and they wind up focusing on the fact that it's a female rather than just having a strong lead who happens to be female.
Mm-hmm.
Now I don't know if I've written a strong female lead in Nightshade Unicorn, which I'm going to plug because it comes out next week.
That's important.
Yeah, it is. And
you got to market yourself.
Nightshadeunicorn.com. I don't know if I'm going to have a chance to set up pre-orders, but I'm going to try to. You might be able to order already if you're hearing this on February 22nd. Yeah, I don't know if I didn't set out to write a strong female lead. I just wrote a story where the protagonist happens to be female. And she's going to have some tough times. And she's going to find a way to overcome those times. And she's not going to be celebrating like at the cost of anybody else. But she's just going to face her challenges and overcome her challenges. Anyway, so yeah, check it out. Nightshade Unicorn, Forerunner, that's book one. And it's available next week. But getting back into your stats. So 8% of the whole teen section could be termed popular. And of that 8%, the top 17%, about 1% of all books, represent most of the total circulation. And then out of all the books, or is out the 28% that haven't gone out this year and 8% haven't gone out ever. Is that all the books or is that of this cross section of the popular? That's all the books. I would have to think, because if they haven't gone out forever, how would we call them popular? What is popular varies by geographic area. Excuse me.
No, so that's all the teen books.
It's true. It's
yeah. Well, and that one's always interesting to see. Like this is much more a, you know, library story than book specifically, but
okay.
So like my previous manager, she was the one who opened the branch in a new branch out in the Magna Library, which is the you know, for those of you who don't know Salt Lake Valley, it's the very west edge of the valley, like right up against the mountains on the west there.
Uh-huh.
And at the same time, they're building a library in Harriman, which is also in the west side of the valley, but at the very south end. And so the administration's like, well, we have to get our opening day collection ready, which is, you know, that's a huge thing because you got to buy everything. Whereas, like, normally you're just buying the new stuff and just, you know, you can do it bit by bit. But this is, you got to buy everything the library needs. So let's have the two of you sit down and do it together so it makes it easier work. It was a disaster.
Well, I imagine
because... Well, it's like, even, you know, same valley, not that dissimilar demographics, but the needs of the Magna population versus the needs of the Harriman population were so different that they ended up just having to do it all on their own anyway. Because it's like, you know, so I happen to live in Magna. And so in my neighborhood, I'd probably say, I don't know, half my neighbors are Hispanic. Another decent chunk are Polynesian. And then, of course, there's my particular neighborhood, a lot of them are retirees as well, who most of those are you know, white families. And then in Harriman, it had only a few years earlier been mostly ranches and farms, and now was a lot of new construction. And, well, anyway, so to wrap it up, like, Magna, we needed a lot more books on Catholic interest. And, like, also, like, crystal healing books and occult and UFOs. And Harriman needed a lot more Latter-day Saint books and farming books. And so it's, like, only a few miles separate, but what the population needed was very different. Well, not everything. There's a lot of crossover. But, you know, the demographics and the needs of each population do vary a lot. And we need to try and serve them.
I think we're going... a little long, which is fine, and I don't want to cut off the conversation, but I will cut off the episode. So I'll kind of make a line of demarcation here, and we'll let the listeners go, and then they can catch us again. Now, for our listeners, you will hear this conversation continue. We'll pick right up where we left off. In March, and that could be March 7th, or it could be 14th, 21st. I haven't decided yet, but it will be in March. So for the listeners again, sorry, Jerry, just bear with us 1 second. For the listeners, remember, today is February 22nd. My book, Nightshade Unicorn Forerunner, will be available for the public on February 28th. I hope to set up a pre-order before then, so you might be able to go and order it right now. Whether that's the case or not, you will be able to find out by going to nightshadeunicorn.com. And we'll catch you next time on the Grand Hill Chronicles podcast.